At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is Great Debates in Fitness and in Health, episode number 6. This is where Dr. Austin Baracchi and I debate things. Oh, I crush him in the debate. That's let's be honest, that's what happens. So are you ready to get your butt kicked again or what?
I mean, whatever you need to tell yourself, that's fine.
Look, man, your batting average in the case file stuff is very, very good. I need something, you know, I need something. So let me hang my hat on this.
Totally fine by me.
Okay, fair enough. So if you're new to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, thank you for joining us. If you've not heard one of these Great Debates episodes before, well, let me give you the lowdown. So why we picked this format is we pick, you know, maybe controversial topics or controversial takes in the health and fitness industry that we feel like we have some subject matter expertise within. And because we have expertise within this, we kind of know both sides of the argument, so to speak. And so I think it's helpful for learning and also explaining our current positions on any one of these topics. Also, it's generally fun just to argue with each other because I think we get to come to a more complete understanding at the end. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. And just again, if there's folks who've not heard this before, we force ourselves to take opposing positions, even if we don't necessarily believe those things, just as a contrived aspect of this exercise.
Yeah. To be clear, whatever position that we end up taking does not necessarily align with our actual beliefs. And usually at the end, we kind of talk about our actual positions. So the format here, now this is a loose program. We don't have a moderator. We don't have, you know, a timer or a bell or anything like that. But what we try to do is spend about 5 minutes per question. We have 10 questions. So you do the math on how long this episode's going to be and then look at the runtime and see if we've held to those sort of time limitations. But the first person will pick the affirmative or the negative, and then they get 2 minutes to kind of go off. And then the other person takes the opposite position, gets 2 minutes to respond. And then the person who started gets a 1 minute rebuttal. Again, loose program. We don't adhere to that at all. So Austin, I'm going to give you the honors here. Just, you know, I want to give you some chance at this. So let's get this started. The first topic we're going to talk about is intermittent fasting. Now, intermittent fasting consists of multiple different timing schedules for periodic, regular, extended food avoidance, including alternate day fasting or other similar full day fasting patterns, and also time restricted feeding, where a day's food is consumed over a 6 to 8 hour period, allowing for an 18 or 14 hour fasting period. Listeners may be most familiar with the version of intermittent fasting that restricts feeding to only between 1 and 9 p.m., for example. So the debate proposition is as follows. Intermittent fasting is beneficial for health and weight loss. Austin?
Okay. So the other thing we sometimes do is we'll take a particular position to alley-oop the other person and set them up when they are perhaps more familiar with some of the data, as is the case here. So I'll kind of discuss what has historically been some of the purported benefits of this. So I'll take the affirmative that it is, yes, beneficial. Of course, as you mentioned, there's a bunch of different ways in which intermittent fasting can be set up, but ranging from extremes of like alternate days or extended fasts to just a daily period where you limit your eating to a particular time window. I think the latter is one that is more accessible to people and more often what they're getting at. Sometimes it is a later in the day type fast, like you said, between 1 and 9 p.m. Other times it's more concentrate your feedings in the earlier part of the day. And there's been various purported benefits to this strategy over time. Some people have suggested that it has benefits for this, you know, cellular process called autophagy that I'm sure you can, you know, address and I recognize we'll debunk here shortly. But others relate to things, for example, like our insulin sensitivity tends to fluctuate throughout the day. We tend in general to be a bit more sensitive in the earlier part of the day and a little bit less in the later part of the day. And the theory being that maybe matching your food intake to periods of higher insulin sensitivity earlier in the day feedings and limiting things later in the day may have some benefits there. This also ties into the entire field of research that was pretty hot in the couple of years ago called chrononutrition or chronobiology relating to our diurnal kind of rhythms earlier in the day, later in the day, kind of variation in our physiology. And perhaps that there may be strategies to kind of match your food intake best to your own kind of diurnal or biologic rhythms. And the idea being that, you know, there was maybe some preliminary evidence that improved glycemic control or your blood sugar levels, particularly in patients with metabolic syndrome and diabetes. And potentially even some impacts on weight loss, although the majority of impacts on weight loss do ultimately end up seeming to come down to overall calorie intake. And this does, in fact, seem to be a way to restrict people's overall daily calories if you restrict your eating to a particular window of time. The most perhaps annoying way that I can say that it is beneficial for health and weight loss is to say, well, the opposite of intermittent fasting would be continuous feeding, just constant calorie or energy intake, which seems like a ridiculous concept. But there are a lot of people who, you know, just basically graze nonstop all day. But the extreme situation of this is actually something that we see in clinical settings in hospitalized patients in the ICU, where we'll have patients on continuous tube feeds sometimes. If they're unable to eat for whatever reason, they can get basically a tube feeding formula that meets their nutritional needs, you know, overall, but it is delivered in this continuous slow infusion type pattern. And there have been plenty of, you know, there's a decent amount of data looking at that and indicating that there are some negative consequences to just continuous nonstop calorie intake in terms of inducing insulin resistance, for example, compared with having what we call more bolus feeding, where you get a meal and then a break in between, and you get a meal and you get a break in between in terms of insulin sensitivity and muscle protein synthesis and things like that. So what I've laid out is a whole hodgepodge of different theoretical, purported, and in some cases, evidence-based benefits to at least having periods during the day when you are not, in fact, eating. The other, you know, consideration here is like when we're talking about intermittent fasting, do we just mean that you go periods of time between meals not eating? Or is there unique benefits to spending extended periods of the day without food intake or alternate days, et cetera? So I'll leave the rest to you.
Yeah, no, that I think that was a great summary of what would be the affirmative position. And rather than bury the lead and go through a bunch of, you know, definitions of what is intermittent fasting and this, that, and the other to really clarify what we're talking about here, I think it's well understood that we're talking about periodic intervals of avoiding food and then jamming all your food into like one period of time. So time-restricted feeding. When you look at the actual evidence on whether it's cardiometabolic outcomes, so risk of heart disease, proxies for blood sugar management, so hemoglobin A1C, when you look at cholesterol levels, when you look at weight loss trajectory in individuals who are subjected to the intermittent fasting protocol versus a regular sort of traditional dietary pattern, there's no unique benefit to following the intermittent fasting sort of approach. And so that's kind of the gist here. If you agree that you can answer this question, like whether or not intermittent fasting is beneficial for health and weight loss by through empirical data, basically just testing it, and then you look at the data and it says, well, no, there's no unique benefit to following this, then great. That answers the question and allows us to further discuss the role of using this sort of approach, whether it's in a clinical setting or whether it's in, you know, a more dietary pattern preference sort of setting. And I think that's probably the most useful discussion. So it's not that intermittent fasting is bad per se, because some people prefer this sort of dietary pattern approach. They want to, that's easy for them to adhere to a health promoting dietary pattern with respect to energy intake if they don't eat during periods of time. Also, there's decent evidence in individuals with insulin resistance or issues managing their blood sugar. If they shift most of their meals towards the earlier hours in the day. So that sort of chrononutrition you alluded to, where people eat most of their calories at breakfast and lunch and then a smaller dinner and then don't eat a lot in the evening hours. That kind of goes out the window when people exercise at night, but that's a different sort of discussion there. And then also to your point, in the clinical setting with continuous tube feeds versus bolus feeding. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good evidence that people should not be eating all day, you know, if you can avoid it. Doesn't mean that those folks don't lose weight though, because they do, but whether or not there are other, you know, health-related sequelae. So if it's loss of muscle mass, insulin resistance, for example, those things all tend to do a little bit worse with continuous feeding compared with bolus feeding in that particular setting. So I think if I had to summarize this, it's that there's not a unique benefit to intermittent fasting with respect to health outcomes that have been tested or weight loss as it's been tested. The sort of theoretical mechanisms, whether it's autophagy or something, that's actually been measured, and that's pretty much only related to calorie deficit or calorie surplus. So a traditional dietary pattern versus an intermittent fasting-related dietary pattern, if it's the same amount of energy intake, the amount of autophagy is going to be about the same. Same thing with inflammatory profile, same thing with, you know, various hormones of interest that people might be, you know, get geeked out on. And so, again, all of that is sort of mechanistic, theoretical, potential benefit. But then when you look at the actual outcomes, whether it's weight loss, whether it's proxies for health-related sort of trajectory or actual health outcomes, there's just no real benefit there. That doesn't mean that we don't think that intermittent fasting is a fine way to eat. It's just not like a preferred approach because it doesn't have enough evidence to show that it's superior. So it is an approach, but whether it's a superior approach remains yet to be proven in the literature. And I think that's the best way I can summarize it.
Yeah. So if I can kind of translate, because there were some aspects of that, that again, if we have a new listener who's not familiar with a lot of this topic or the language, might be helpful to kind of translate some of that. It sounds like, and I think we would agree that this is an approach, as you said, that if it meets somebody's preferences and lets them meet their dietary kind of pattern goals and things like that, is completely fine. But for those for whom this is not a preferred way to eat, if they say are trying to lose weight, they do not need to go out of their way and suffer to force their preferred dietary pattern to fit into this paradigm under the guise that it is going to give them even more benefits compared with if they ate the same kind of overall calories, macro breakdown, types of foods, meals, just distributed in a different way. Yeah. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And I think for the number of people who find intermittent fasting easier to stick to, they're like, look, I didn't want to eat breakfast in the first place. This allows me to eat the correct amount of calories that I need to sustain a healthy weight and body composition if I otherwise just restrict my food from 1 to 9 p.m. For every person where that's the case, other people will, by missing breakfast and maybe, you know, an early morning snack, will overeat during that period to and compensate. And so it's like, some, you know, horses for courses. You're going to pick the right approach. Well, I had a question on my Instagram, Ask Me Anything. I was like, hey, how long is too long for like a calorie deficit? And actually, this relates to this intermittent fasting thing, or fasting in general. The longest fast we have on record is over a year. I think it's 382 days by Angus Barbieri. He was 456 pounds when he voluntarily admitted himself to the hospital, then did not eat anything for over a year, 380 something days, and lost 250 something pounds. I think it was 180 pounds when he was discharged. And it's like, well, you could fast for a long time. And in fact, if you wanted to be a real jerk and someone asks, hey, what's the fastest way to lose weight? You just don't eat. You know, whether that supports like other sort of things you want to do with respect to like physical performance, you know, social sort of interactions or whatever. But yeah, the honest truth, if someone's asked, well, what's the best diet to lose weight the fastest? Well, it'd probably be just not eating, I guess, if you had to say. So
get admitted to a medical ICU or a burn unit and then don't eat. You will rapidly lose weight.
Yeah. Can confirm. So, all right. That was question number one. Question number two, I'll take the lead on this one. All right. So this is about zone two cardio. Again, Austin's favorite. I just feel like when I find questions that we could debate on, I just pick the ones that I know you love. And this is another one that you love. So exercise intensity refers to how hard the body must work to perform the activity. So the work rate, the effort level, the metabolic challenge, if you will. In conditioning, Intensity specifically refers to the energy demands during exercise, where higher intensity exercise requires more energy than lower intensity exercise. Intensity for conditioning can be communicated in a number of different ways, such as metabolic equivalents, or METs, rate of perceived exertion, that's RPE, percentage of max heart rate, and many more. Now, recently, the five-zone model has become popular on social media. It's been in the literature for a long period of time, but there's been a rise of this discussion on social media, where there are five discrete zones, zones one through five, that correlate with heart rate and for other physiological variables. So things like blood lactate levels, percentage of VO2 max, and so on. Now, zone two cardio is generally accepted to be an intensity level that is below the first lactate threshold and is somewhere around 65 to 75% of an individual's max heart rate, though this is highly variable by not only individual, but also mode of exercise. So here is the debate proposition. Zone two cardio is the best conditioning intensity for health. And I will start with this. I don't know that I'm going to set you up on this. I just think I'm going to do it straight. I'm going to do it normal.
Go for it.
I will take the negative that zone two conditioning is not the best conditioning intensity for health. My rationale for this is that we do not yet have good evidence that this particular intensity level confers or generates unique fitness and or health-related adaptations that lead to better outcomes, whether it's increased health span, so how long someone lives without disease, improvement of disease processes that people already have, so a reduction in disease burden, or other sort of metrics for those things. And so when people say that zone two cardio is where you should be doing the bulk of your conditioning intensity in, I think that's a fine thing to say because it's generally at an intensity level where you can do a lot of it and it's not very fatiguing in general. But it doesn't mean that it's uniquely beneficial compared to zone one versus zone three or zone four or anywhere in between. Further, most people who say they're doing zone two cardio, they're doing it by heart rate proxy, which is a way to sort of, you know, predict that you're in this zone. But if you're not checking your blood lactate, for example, then you don't really know. And that kind of leads to why I have this position. Even if there's like huge studies on zone two cardio in a population. If they're not being measured, you know, their blood lactate, for example, how do we really know? You know, so I suspect my colleague will having to take the affirmative on this might make an argument that if we know that an improved cardiorespiratory fitness, which can be measured by VO2 max, for example, we know that improvements in cardiorespiratory fitness, that there's a dose-dependent relationship between that and sort of health span or reduction in cardiovascular disease risk and stuff like that, that we would want to improve cardiorespiratory fitness the most. And if you agree that doing a lot of zone two cardio is the best way to do that, maybe from a programming standpoint, then you could make the argument that zone two is maybe beneficial for health, uniquely beneficial for health. I think that strains the limitations of the current evidence, but we'll see what you have to say on this, Austin.
Yeah, this one's a little bit tougher because I do not claim to be an expert on this body of literature. I think that there are, you know, people who really nerd out in the weeds in the literature on this. I think I've heard of a researcher. I think his name is like Inigo San Millan or something, who's a PhD guy who's one of the main, you know, proponents of this strategy, making claims about this method of conditioning having kind of the optimal effect on oxidative metabolism, meaning having to do with how your mitochondria, you know, your powerhouse of the cell, do their job, and measuring this using lactate type measurements, because that is a marker of what's going on in terms of oxidative metabolism, anaerobic metabolism, things like that. So my mental model and approach to this is in fact kind of what you described, which is a parallel to how we talk about strength training in terms of the volume of training being one of the biggest drivers of the adaptations that we get, especially cumulatively over like an entire training career. And it's very difficult to do very high volumes of very high intensity work. And what I fear is that by promoting this, it leads to this mental like exclusion of other, you know, intensity ranges, or a thought that those other intensity ranges should be actively avoided. And so you know, you can make an argument that this type of conditioning has maybe all intensity ranges have unique benefits to that intensity range in terms of what adaptations they drive. But to get a broad base of physical development and cardiorespiratory adaptations, in the same way we talk about strength adaptations, there are very justifiable reasons to expose oneself to a variety of different activities and intensity ranges. And so you, while on one hand, they might make the argument, for example, that doing high volumes of zone two exercise optimally promotes, you know, mitochondrial function, fat oxidation, mitochondrial biogenesis, you build a whole bunch more mitochondria, for example, you still need exposure to the really high intensity ranges to kind of develop that level of performance out of your mitochondria, to actually make them function at that level. And so I don't know that I can really strongly take a counter position here for two reasons. One is that I don't like the implication that, you know, it is just the best all around for health. That is just way too broad of a claim to be to be made. And also, I lack sufficient content expertise on primary literature in this field to be you know, mouthing off about it confidently. So I will withhold further commentary.
Yeah. Do you think that some of this, like the pendulum has almost swung the other way? Because maybe a decade ago, it was like high intensity interval training, do hot, you know, hit and sprint intervals, whatever. So high intensity interval training, it's really difficult to come up with a zone for that because it depends how you're doing it. Like if you do 2 minute sprints, one, you're not sprinting for 2 minutes, but at high intensity, that's probably zone three, zone four, you know, if you're pushing it zone four. And, you know, sprint interval stuff might be what some authors would call like zone six or zone seven even. So you think the pendulum has swung the other way, like away from high intensity interval training, which was originally claimed to be uniquely beneficial to more this, you know, low intensity steady state? Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, it is. It is interesting because, as you mentioned in the past, when high intensity was the rage, it also even bled over into the strength training world because, of course, they wanted to get all the conditioning cake and eat it too, you know, to get supposedly all the benefits you possibly could without actually having to do the work of conditioning, which obviously on its face is silly and wishful thinking. And so now we're I see commentators in this space who are big fans of high volumes of low intensity work, which again, most of my swimming career was spent doing high volumes of lower intensity work. Like I'm certainly not somebody who avoids this, and I still do it these days. But you know, I see commentary like, you know, for people who are getting into, you know, activity and doing some conditioning, they shouldn't even go anywhere near high intensity or attempt high intensity intervals until they've like built this large base of zone two work. And it reminds me of like, you know, silly people in the strength training world who nobody should barbell squat until you can, you know, meet some arbitrary metric or standard, right? When we have like actual direct evidence on taking completely untrained people and having them do interval work, even if it is not true 10 out of 10 effort all out sprints, but getting like substantial improvements in various markers of metabolic health, glycemic control, blood pressure, not to mention their VO2 max and kind of metrics of actual aerobic performance and things like that, who are, you know, minimally or untrained, and you get them doing, you know, a few bouts of something a little hard and you can see benefit. So there's just like no kind of real argument there. Now, if you want to optimally develop somebody as a, you know, an aerobic athlete, then yeah, you kind of have to do a lot of aerobic work to develop that. And doing high intensity intervals is fundamentally not an aerobic task.
Yeah. Yeah, I do wonder also, so imagine somebody asked you like, hey, what is the optimal intensity range for resistance training? And you'd be like, well, it depends how many reps you're doing, what's the total program, the proximity to failure. But if you were forced to come up with an intensity range, you'd probably say something for traditional resistance training between like 60 to 90%, 60 to 85%, I mean, whatever, you'd come up with some number.
60 to 90 is what came to mind for me too before you even said it. So that's probably where I would fall.
Yeah, and it's like with a bunch of caveats in there, but that's so wide.
Yeah.
So that's like saying for conditioning, it's the same thing. Yeah, somewhere between 60 to 90% of your max heart rate, which represents effectively all of the zones.
Right. So, and even the same thing applies here. If you take somebody who's completely untrained and you have them do some strength training with 40% of whatever they're one, like, they're going to get better. So it's like, can I even argue that?
Yeah. Or even blood flow restriction training, like 30%, you know, stuff like that. The other thing, the last thing, and then we can move on, has to do with, you know, the people who are already meeting the current exercise guidelines. It's like, you know, less than 20% worldwide will, if you survey them, you know, will say, yeah, I'm doing the muscular strengthening activities, the twice weekly resistance training, and I'm doing enough conditioning to meet the current guidelines. So let's just say that you took all of the people who are doing the current conditioning guidelines and you made sure that all of the conditioning they were doing was zone two. Do we think that that would lead to better health outcomes in those individuals? And that, I think, is the crux of this question. And I think the answer to that is unlikely, but maybe. And I think that's probably the best answer I can give to this question.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm gonna err even further on the side of I don't think so. If they're meeting the cumulative kind of dose effort, the idea that I'm gonna see a splay in like mortality curves or something like that at that level seems just almost implausible to me.
Yeah, the bigger thing I would say, rather than being afraid of people doing too much high intensity stuff, so stuff in like zone three, zone four, whatever, is people who are doing activities that are not, that would not count as exercise because they're not intense enough. So like below zone one type stuff, the sort of not exercise but otherwise activity, you know. And again, that's going to vary based on an individual's current fitness level, you know, and the mode, the activity that we're talking about. But I think that's probably my bigger concern, is it not being intense enough rather than it being too intense. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, you're describing like people doing activities of daily living and calling it exercise, which that's a scenario where, you know, yes, I would certainly not discount the idea of people like moving around and, you know, engaging with their environment, particularly compared with being just completely sedentary, because there are just overwhelming and rapidly accumulating harms of, you know, bed rest being the extreme example of that, right? But to use your same kind of paradigm here, if the entirety of somebody's supposed conditioning activity is being met by just like walking around their house or getting the mail, if I compare that scenario to somebody actually doing, you know, call it zone two, that in that scenario, yeah, I would expect to see more significant health differences between the two. So that's a nice contrast between the two scenarios that we talked about, just moving around in your environment versus doing a whole bunch of zone two or whatever conditioning versus doing all zone two compared with doing a wide range of intensities to meet the same kind of like cumulative conditioning volume effort kind of met minute sort of deal over the week. In one scenario, I do expect to see health differences. In the other, I'm not particularly confident that we would.
Yeah. Oh, look at
very,
us.
Very nuanced points you are eliciting here. Nice job.
Well, Dr. Nuance, as it were. All right. We're 30 minutes into this. We're two questions deep. We should maybe stick to our
call
time.
It a 5-minute intro, but yeah, we can cut these next ones shorter.
Fair enough. All right. Question number three. This is about caffeine. Now, consumed in coffee, tea, soft drinks, and small amounts of chocolate, caffeine is the most widely used psychoactive, pharmacologically active substance in the world. About 85% of the U.S. population consumes at least one caffeinated beverage per day, with the average intake being about 165 milligrams per day. That's about 2 cups of coffee. At present, there are no specific recommendations for caffeine intake in the United States, though the FDA did release a letter in August of 2012 stating that caffeine intakes up to 400 milligrams per day, that's about 4 to 5 cups of coffee, is safe for healthy adults. Despite this, many have apprehension about ingesting caffeine due to their fear of negative side effects. The debate proposition that Dr. Baraki will lead off is that caffeine is net bad for health.
I'm going to say no. I mean, it's also difficult to make a claim like this about any substance because as we've said before, all things are poison. whatever that original quote was, right? Poison makes the dose of anything, right?
Shout out to Paracelsus.
Yeah. Water is net bad for health when consumed in quantities excess of your ability to excrete that that water, right? So I have much more concerns about the vehicle and the means through which caffeine is being consumed than I do about the caffeine itself. You mentioned that FDA letter up to 400 milligrams per day. I actually haven't read the data on which that's based to see what concerns, if any, did they have beyond that, or was it just like hasn't been studied more very, very rigorously beyond that?
Correct.
Aside from just knowing what the, you know, toxic dose or LD50 or whatever the case is for caffeine, which has been established. And it's pretty difficult to get up to that through, like, you know, habitual routine, like life consumption. But as we've discussed before, the vehicle that it comes in is much more potentially a source of concern. The most extreme being just people taking pure caffeine anhydrous powder, which we talked about in one of our, you know, case files episodes of somebody who effectively overdosed on caffeine rather easily by consuming it in that form. And then the other forms that would raise concern would be forms that are highly calorie containing, mainly sugar sweetened beverages, not even so, you know, just like energy drinks, broadly speaking. Like if it's a zero calorie energy, I still don't have great concerns about that. But if it's something that is heavily sugar sweetened, or if it's caffeine coming through the form of, you know, a Starbucks milkshake or something like that, that contains 700 calories in the beverage, I'm more concerned about the calories in that than I am the caffeine. So the vehicle and what comes along with it is a much greater source of concern, whereas the caffeine itself, I have very little concerns about from most metrics of health.
Yeah, as you alluded to, my concern, so I'll have to take the affirmative that caffeine is net bad for health.
Because it comes in those other forms.
Yeah, like the majority of caffeine consumption is not through black coffee, unfortunately, so people are missing out. One, you're ruining potentially good coffee by dumping a bunch of stuff into it. Like a little milk is fine. I don't prefer that, but I could see how that would be tasty. But other stuff, you know, these 600 to 1600 calorie, you know, sort of bombs that are basically, it's like a milkshake with a little touch of coffee flavoring in it. The majority of caffeine consumption, particularly in the United States, coincides with sugar added to the beverage, whether it's a soda, whether it's tea, whether it's coffee, or something else like that. So I think if I had to make this argument that caffeine intake in the United States is net bad for health, it's because the majority of this consumption comes with the addition of calories. And if we reduced intake of caffeine by reducing intake of sugar-sweetened beverages, then yes, health would be better. But if we just removed the caffeine and kept everything else the same, I don't suspect there'd be a great benefit for health. I think the risks about, you know, arrhythmia, blood pressure, cardiovascular-related side effects are overblown in general when you look at the evidence on this, especially in habitual consumers, so not folks who are not naive to caffeine. You see that there's a little to no sort of impact on those risks. The biggest risk from caffeine consumption outside of the vehicle in which it comes in, you know, with the sugar potentially, has to do with like sleep phase stuff, and people consuming caffeine far too late into the day and it negatively affecting their sort of sleep architecture, sleep efficiency, sleep duration, things of that nature. So I have some concerns over that, but that's more of a product of modern society and demands and such like that. But again, I don't think that reducing caffeine intake in and of itself is likely to make a bump or a dent in sort of health trajectory in the nation, unless, again, we're just talking about removing sugar-sweetened beverages and such.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment you kind of alluded to, of like snap your fingers and we're in like alternate universe where all of our drinks are suddenly decaffeinated. And assuming we get everybody through their like couple days of caffeine withdrawal headaches, what does health trajectory look like beyond that? And I'm not convinced that there would be a huge signal of benefit there. I'm also not convinced, even for those for whom caffeine disrupts sleep, that like these aren't people who would otherwise have perfect sleep.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Right. It's not like their, you know, duration, bedtime, sleep hygiene, sleep habit, all that stuff is like perfect, but it's just the caffeine that's impacting that. It's probably a constellation of behaviors. And so I think that there probably wouldn't be a significant benefit for that. I don't know that there would be harm either, but it just is.
Yeah, I think if I had to do a little nannyism or whatever, I would remove caffeine pills and caffeine powder from the market. Like, or at least have some sort of licensure required to obtain these things, because that probably represents the greatest risk of caffeine toxicity, whether it's through accidental exposure from like, you know, kid getting into it, for example, or people just overdosing because they read the label wrong. We talk about that in Case Files 1. So, hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is nearly here, which means that warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them and support your fitness goals with Factor's fresh, never frozen, dietitian approved meals. Factor is America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service and is much healthier than most takeout meals, which tend to be very high in calories due to both the portion size and the ingredients. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the takeout trap and let Factor do the work for you. Now, Factor has options to help fuel you up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. They're ready in 2 minutes, and they even have protein plus options to make sure each meal has at least 30 grams of protein in it. This summer, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered right to your door. Ready in just 2 minutes, no prep, no mess. Head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey everyone, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine here. Want to know one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Now, I've been using Babbel for about 2 months now to learn French. On most days, I open the app and I do a review or a new lesson that's been customized for me. Now, my French isn't that great yet, but the spaced repetition learning is really helping, especially since Babbel's tips and tools are rooted in real-life situations and delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice with what you've learned in the real world. They also have speech recognition technology that helped me with my pronunciation and getting the accent right.
Oui, bien sûr.
Oui, bien sûr.
Je m'appelle Alice.
Je m'appelle Alice. We got a very special offer for our listeners. Right now, you can get 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/barbellpod. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/barbellpod, spelled BABBEL.com/barbellpod. Rules and restrictions may apply. Head over to Babbel today.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Growing businesses and finance professionals, you need Bill, Spend, and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software. It's powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card, which helps growing companies scale with credit lines of $500 to $15 million, automated expense reports, and as many virtual cards as you need. For a limited time, get $500 when you get started with Bill, Spend, and Expense. Request a demo at bill.com/get500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
All right. Next question. This one is probably your favorite topic. So this is about statins. So statins are the most widely prescribed class of medications in the United States. Dating back as far as 1987, lovastatin was the first statin approved for commercial use. Since then, tens of millions of Americans have been treated with this class of medications in order to reduce blood lipid levels. Now, statins work by inhibiting a critical enzyme involved in cholesterol synthesis called HMG-CoA reductase, thereby reducing intracellular cholesterol production. The decrease in intracellular free cholesterol triggers the upregulation of low-density lipoprotein receptors, that's LDL receptors, on the cell surface, which ultimately removes circulating LDL particles from the blood. However, they have been met with heavy skepticism and increasing controversy regarding their effectiveness and potential risk for adverse side effects. The debate proposition is as follows, Dr. Austin Baracki, you will lead. Statins have too many side effects to be prescribed as often as they are. Thoughts?
Yeah. Okay. I'll take the negative on this to say, no, I disagree with that proposition. First is the context in which statins are most indicated to be prescribed or most recommended to be prescribed is in high risk, you know, patients for cardiovascular disease. That means like secondary prevention, somebody who's already had a heart attack, already had a stroke, and we treat them with these medications to get a fair amount of subsequent risk reduction. Broadly speaking, these medicines have a pretty consistent reduction in the risk of cardiovascular events like a heart attack or a stroke, for example, in the range of about 20 to 30%. And so we're talking about an average, I'll call it 25% relative risk reduction for those kind of complications of what is and has been for a long time the leading cause of death in the US and the leading cause of premature death worldwide as well. And so I think it's difficult to overstate how important it is to have a tool that can reduce that risk for such a broadly prevalent problem worldwide. So that's the pro side of like what their utility is here. The other aspect of this question has to do with the side effects. And so this is something that these are probably, if I had to guess, like the most studied pharmacologic agent in the medical literature. And so this has been studied in all sorts of ways because you will hear a lot of anecdotes about people's experiences being on them. You will read on the internet about people's experiences being on them. But these types of things, while people's experiences, you know, are not necessarily to be discounted, they experience what they experienced, they come with a lot of potential preconceived ideas, beliefs, expectations, and what we call the nocebo effect, the opposite of placebo, when people have a worse experience or worse outcomes than they would have otherwise had if they didn't know something or believe something ahead of time. And so the best and most rigorous way to study these kind of side effects is to do properly blinded trials where people have no idea what they're taking. And then they alternate, for example, between taking a pill like a statin, taking a, you know, a nonsense pill that's not a statin, and then periods of time where they take nothing at all. And this is, in fact, the specific study design of something called the Samson trial that was done now going on probably 2 or 3 years ago. People were given prescriptions for pills that were either statins, and they were also got pill bottles, you know, along their treatment course that were just placebo pills. And then they had periods of time where they took breaks and didn't take anything at all. And every day in a phone app, they were to rate their intensity of side effect. The most common one that people worry about is muscle related side effects, like just aches, myalgias, muscle aches is a common concern that people have. And so at the end of this study data collection period where they had either the statin or the placebo pill, or they had periods of time where they didn't take any medication at all, there was very little to almost no difference between periods when people were taking the statin and the placebo pill in terms of the rating of their severity of symptoms. But all of them went away during periods of time when they were not taking a pill, whether the statin or the placebo pill, which suggested that it was the act, the ritual, the expectation after taking a pill that you are going to experience some side effects that was a very large contributor to upwards of 90% of the reported side effect that people had. So this is one major source of, you know, purported side effects. Now, this is not discounting that sometimes people do, in fact, have muscle aches and pains and sometimes more severe muscle-related side effects from these medications, but it does not seem to be nearly as common or prevalent as people believe or expect when they learn about these things. That's thing one. Thing two is that it is a dose-dependent issue, meaning that the higher you crank up the dose on these medications, the more likely people are to experience these things. And so there's been a trend in recent years in general and in my own personal practice to do much less prescribing of maximum doses of these medications, except for the highest risk scenarios. So people who've had heart attacks, strokes, recurrent heart attacks, unfortunately, they should probably be on, you know, the highest tolerable dose of these medicines. But for the rest that are not necessarily in that situation, we tend to use combinations of different medications at lower doses to get both the benefit that we get from them with the least risk of these types of side effects. And that seems to work really well for a lot of the people that I work with. So instead of, you know, cranking up their atorvastatin to 80 milligrams, which is the highest dose of that, I might use half of that or a quarter of that, something like that, sometimes even less, and combine it with a different non-statin agent, use multiple things at low doses, and we can get bigger bangs for our buck with the least risk of side effects. The last thing I'll mention that you'll hear about, you'll read about, is statins cause diabetes, quote unquote. And this has been a pretty consistent signal for a long time that we see people's blood sugars rise a little bit when they're on statins. But similarly, this is mostly a dose-related effect. The higher the dose that people are on, the more of this effect we tend to see. And so the same argument applies. I tend to use much more conservative doses outside of those highest possible risk scenarios. And then the last thing is this data, when you look at this, this was actually just published within the past week, a giant new kind of meta-analysis in Lancet. I'm sure you saw it from Journal Watch yesterday, which we both use to keep track of a lot of things, that the people for whom who experience kind of a new diagnosis of diabetes on these statin medications, the issue here is that the diagnosis of diabetes is defined in binary fashion using a blood test, like a hemoglobin A1C. If you hit 6.5% on your A1C, boom, suddenly you quote unquote have diabetes. Whereas before, when you were at 6.3%, you did not have diabetes. But that doesn't mean that when you were at 6.3%, you were perfectly healthy and you had no blood sugar issues. And so what's been found is that not only is it this dose-related effect, but also those who receive new diagnosis of diabetes when they're on these medicines, they were already teetering very close to meeting that diagnostic criteria. So somebody who goes from a 6.3 to a 6.5, suddenly they've reached that, again, arbitrary kind of diagnostic threshold of diabetes, but they were not in great shape before that happened. What we don't see is people who have fantastic blood sugar control, whose A1C is 4.6% or something like that, well in the normal range. And then you put them on a moderate dose, or even you could even put them on a higher dose of a statin, and then suddenly they come back 6 months later and their A1C is 8%. That just fundamentally does not happen. But people who kind of either lack this kind of more nuanced understanding of these data or who want to fearmonger about these things, they'll take these, you know, data from studies and then they'll post, you know, on their social media, statins cause diabetes, you should never take them. And it's like, well, there is a whole lot more kind of under the hood to unpack there. And yet, even when patients receive a new diagnosis of diabetes, because maybe their blood sugar ticked up that little bit to meet that threshold, they still have a lower risk of developing heart attacks and strokes while they're taking these medicines compared to when they didn't. So I've expanded on a lot of different considerations here as it relates to these side effects. I think the summary is that these drugs have a pretty consistent 20 to 30% reduction in risk for these things that they're intended to treat. The muscle-related side effects, while they do exist, a very, very large proportion of this can be explained by a nocebo-type effect and also can be mitigated by using lower doses of the medications. And then the other major concern as it relates to diabetes is that people typically already don't have great blood sugar, and then very high doses of these medicines can tip them over. And so the converse would be manage their rest of their lifestyle to get their blood sugar under better control anyway. And if we can use lower or moderate doses of these medicines, we can also avoid that as well.
Yeah, you know, it was longer than 2 minutes, but I would like to draw the listener's attention to the duration of Austin's answer is directly proportional to his interest in the topic.
I think it's just my understanding of it as opposed to, you know, details of zone two literature, which is lacking.
Yeah. Well, for everyone, perhaps. Okay, so if I'm forced to take the affirmative that statins do, in fact, have too many side effects to be prescribed as often as they are, perhaps teeing you up for a nice little rebuttal here, I think I have to go to the literature regarding number needed to treat and number needed to harm. Now, these are two statistically related terms that have to do with, yeah, exactly how they sound. How many patients do you have to treat with a statin to get a benefit versus how many patients do you have to treat with a statin for there to be a harm? And so in individuals with known heart disease, so you would call these a high-risk population, you need to treat 83 people with a statin to save one life. You need to treat 39 people to prevent a heart attack. You need to treat 125 people to prevent a stroke. Not too bad. It's not on par with like the Mediterranean diet, which I think is like two, a number needed to treat and exercise. The number needed to treat is like one, for example. But the number needed to harm for statins, it doesn't paint such a great picture. And, you know, maybe this is why there's so much confusion, particularly with individuals who maybe don't actually treat patients or whatever on social media. The number needed to harm for diabetes is 50, meaning that for every 50 patients treated with a statin, one might develop diabetes. But you alluded to some issues there. And one thing you didn't cover in that, which I think you would agree with, is that there's variation within the test itself for diabetes. If it's a hemoglobin A1C, for example, there's variation in that test. So a person who has a, you know, hemoglobin A1C of 6.2, for example, they may already have a one that's above the threshold, but the test that day was read a little low, for example. So there's some issues with that data. But the number needed to treat for myopathy, you know, is 10. The number needed to harm, rather, is 10. So when you take those two things, you compare the number needed to harm, 50 for diabetes, 10 for muscle pain, compared to the number needed to treat for benefit, 83 for one life saved, 39 for a heart attack, 125 for a stroke. I think you could make an argument, you know, that statins have too many potential side effects when you just look at this data. I think your points were well made. But if somebody brought that to you, what would your response be?
Yeah, the first would require a bit of a statistical conversation around that concept of number needed to treat, which is actually a much more flawed metric than we were even taught in medical school for a variety of reasons that I have neither the time to get into now or all of the statistical expertise that I need to explain. But one of the most apparent ones to me in the way these numbers are often thrown around is lacking a consideration of the time component. In other words, one of the important things as it relates to the use of these medicines for treating heart disease risk is that this is a cumulative lifelong process. And so the longer you are treated for to reduce your risk, the benefit actually magnifies over time. So if you say that, you know, the number needed to treat is 80 to save a life, well, that's over what time period? Is that over 5 years? Is that over 25 years? Is that over 50 years? The number needed to treat, meaning the likelihood of benefit actually improves. It gets higher and higher the longer somebody is treated for. And so you want to make sure that you're comparing kind of apples to apples here in terms of what is the likelihood of benefit over X time period compared with the likelihood of a harm over X time period. That's thing one. And then it would be, well, what's the kind of the balance here, the trade-off in terms of the likelihood of benefit versus the likelihood of harm? For example, what I mean by that, if you are that likely to have a life saved, for example, over that period of time, and the harm that you're comparing it with is having some achy muscles, it seems to me that one kind of wins between the two. And additionally, as I mentioned, the muscle risk, the myalgia risk, as was observed in, for example, the Samson trial, where they took the patients who reported having muscle aches on the statin medication, and they showed them this data such that they were like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I had the same muscle aches on the statin and on the placebo. And they said, would you be interested in kind of a re-challenge, trying again? And the significant fraction of people were able to successfully try it again and tolerate it fine. And even if they weren't, the other option would be to try switching to a different option, a different medication agent, whether a statin or a non-statin agent, and then starting out at a lower dose. There's just multiple different ways that we can mitigate that supposed harm in that scenario of, for example, muscle aches, while still maintaining a degree of benefit that we can get. And so that would be the way that I would think about this, is that, again, those harms need to be weighed against the potential benefit. Are they actually equivalent in terms of our consideration of preventing a heart attack or saving a life versus causing some muscle aches or going from a moderate A1C to just crossing that threshold to diagnose diabetes, especially when those harms can be mitigated by either reducing the dose, switching from one agent to another. For example, I don't generally use a lot of simvastatin anymore. That's an older one, especially like high dose simvastatin should never be used anymore. But I'll switch them to a pretty low dose of a rosuvastatin or something like that in certain situations, or non-statin agents altogether, and ezetimibe or some of the newer ones that have come out on the market in recent years as well that work via different mechanisms and therefore have different sets of side effects. So there's a lot to think about here, and that's why it requires, I think, a fair amount of clinical training and experience and working with patients, things like that, to have a sense of all the different dynamics that are at play, instead of somebody who just takes a study conclusion that says statins cause diabetes and then says they should never be used ever, when it's like, that is a stretch.
Yeah, doesn't most things in medicine, well, and to do with humans in general, are not that simple, unfortunately. All right, next question. This is on diabetes. Type 2 diabetes characterized by an elevated blood sugar, insulin resistance, and also reduced insulin secretion from the pancreas. Now, the presence of insulin resistance explains the strong clinical association of type 2 diabetes with obesity and other insulin-resistant states. It's the seventh leading cause of mortality worldwide and affects nearly 1 in 11 people globally. The prevalence of type 2 diabetes has increased dramatically in the United States population over the last two decades, with weight gain as a common underlying risk factor. The debate proposition is type 2 diabetes risk is mostly related to carbohydrate intake. So I will start off with this, and I, perhaps surprisingly to my colleague here, will take the affirmative. Now, I suspect that my colleague is going to talk about the genetic risk of type 2 diabetes, which is actually greater than the risk for type 1 diabetes. There's a stronger genetic component for type 2 diabetes. No argument for me there. I also suspect my colleague will bring up the, you know, weight gain and the genetic component for obesity risk and such, and no argument for me. However, where I'm bringing this argument from is that when you look at how food consumption has changed in the United States over the last 50 years, that corresponds perfectly time-wise with the obesity epidemic, you see a large increase in not only calorie intake, but calorie intake from ultra-processed foods, with the biggest thing changing in the food being the amount of not only added sugars, but also total carbohydrate intake. To me, that is a reasonable sort of argument to make. Yes, fat intake has changed as well. Sodium intake, you can go through micro and macronutrients and come up with all sorts of different dynamics. But I think you could make the argument that carbohydrate intake, because it has increased secondary to an increase in ultra-processed food intake, particularly because of its abundance in the food environment, that has been one of the biggest sort of drivers of type 2 diabetes risk in the United States. To support this claim, I look at, the proportion of diet
in the adult in the United States that comes from ultra-processed foods. It now accounts for over 50% of the average person's diet. While these foods are not carbohydrates in isolation, people aren't just overdosing on sugar cubes, for example, or like other sort of carbohydrate-only type foods. It's mostly a mixture of carbohydrates and fat. My argument would be that if there was reduced amounts of added sugars, whether it's sugar-sweetened beverages, whether it's other ultra-processed foods with added sugars, if those were either eliminated from the food environment, heavily taxed, or otherwise much more difficult to obtain and consume, or were otherwise more satiating, I think that the diabetes risk would precipitously fall. And so I think that there are ways to argue against me, and so I've teed up my colleague here, but I think that it would be the most evidence-based way to argue the affirmative here. And so I fell on that sword for you, and now I'll let you sort of respond.
Yeah, there are several ways, and I'm sure there's probably even more that you're more familiar with that you'll end up arguing against yourself after this. But it kind of evokes similar types of like thought experiments to what we described earlier, where snap our fingers and there's a world where, you know, at an equal level of overall calorie intake, and, you know, say food palatability and food texture and all the other aspects of the food were the same, but the carbohydrates were substituted for fats, for example, what would we observe in practice? And it would be an interesting thing. I don't know for sure. I would not be confident that diabetes rates would precipitously fall in such a scenario, particularly if it was, say, substituted with saturated fats in the food that were just as palatable, tasty, and equal amount of calories. Because fundamentally, kind of common type 2 diabetes due to insulin resistance is most often a manifestation of what I would call cellular energy toxicity. There's too much energy in the cell, leading to, you know, all sorts of downregulation of insulin receptors and sensitivity and things like that as a very oversimplified mechanism. And so this has even been studied where patients with type 2 diabetes have been randomized to, you know, lower fat and lower carbohydrate type diets. And while lower carbohydrate diets can be useful to lower blood sugar levels on average in the short term after that's done, I view that much more as kind of treating a symptom of diabetes compared with treating the underlying cause of it. And it's interesting to take that perspective when a lot of the people in the space who would make a strong argument for like low carb diets to treat diabetes are all about, well, doctors just treat symptoms. They don't treat the underlying cause.
Cause, baby.
Right. When really it's like, well, yeah, I can make your blood sugar levels lower if there's like no sugar in your diet. That's treating a symptom of diabetes when the underlying cause, the insulin resistance, is much more mediated by overall cellular energy toxicity. Again, in common diabetes, there's other forms of diabetes as well, such that when we have people longer term on, say, lower fat, lower carb diets that are equally adhered to with equivalent calorie deficits, for example, in the context of people with obesity, we see pretty similar improvements in their diabetes control long term, regardless of which kind of macronutrient they target, if they want to target one at all, or even if they just want to just like wholesale take their same kind of macronutrient breakdown and reduce the overall calorie intake. We see, again, same thing. We see significant improvements in their diabetes control to very similar levels when this is looked at long term, not looking at just short term fluctuations in blood sugar levels. So those are just a couple, not to draw this out for even longer than it already has been, but those are a few examples. I think that if we really want to get at the root of this issue, the overall energy availability in our food environment of how tasty and prevalent and non-satiating it tends to be in a lot of cases, combined with many, many, many other variables lead to this. And so in general, we're not fans of taking this reductionist of an approach to it's just this one variable. And when this variable has been examined in isolation, it doesn't really seem to pan out that well.
Yeah. I think the best case you can make for like a lower carbohydrate diet, if that's what you took away from this back and forth, which you shouldn't, you know, to be clear. But if you did, you say, well, Jordan said carbohydrates were the root cause. That's the biggest risk factor. The most charitable sort of take you could have on this with respect to management of type 2 diabetes is that it tends to reduce the amount of medications that people need to manage their diabetes compared to something with equivalent amount of calories, but ultimately having more carbohydrates. So that is a favorable take. It's not widely supported, and there's a lot of other variables there, but that's probably the most charitable take. With your thought experiment, you're saying, oh, snap my fingers, people are still eating the same amount of calories, you know, same amount of foods. It's just instead of having as many carbohydrates, it's less. Would you predict an improvement in health trajectory? And I would say no. But my thought, what I led with, is that if you reduced the carbohydrate content, in particular the added sugars from the ultra-processed foods, the sugar-sweetened beverages, if I snapped my finger and that happened, my prediction would be that people eat less calories overall. The obesity epidemic trajectory would sort of plateau or decline, ideally. And then you would likely see a reduction in type 2 diabetes, not only severity, but also prevalence. That would be my prediction. But yeah, if you just, you know, less sugar, but same amount of calories, I would not predict a big difference. Any issues with that? All right, cool. So good. We're halfway through. We're going to come back. We have five more questions we're going to debate right after this break. Thank you so much to Dr. Austin Baracchi for joining me here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Again, this is Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode number 6. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll see you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
The secret to summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Its signature scent of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.